From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Julia Child once said, "Wine is a living liquid containing no preservatives. Its life cycle comprises youth, maturity, old age, and death. When not treated with reasonable respect, it will sicken and die." Well, on today's edition of Please Explain, we're going to talk about wine, what it is, how it's made, and how to care for it, appreciate it, and enjoy it. And we have asked two renowned wine experts to join us. And later they'll be taking your calls. Joshua Wesson is the co-author of Red Wine with Fish and the founder and co-owner of Best Sellers Wine Stores. And Roger Deghorn is a master sommelier with the Tribeca restaurant Chanterelle. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Let's begin with you, Roger. Does wine occur naturally or did someone have to invent it?
Oh, I think it probably occurred naturally, and then it was grape juice or grapes that were just lying around, and people didn't know what to do with it, didn't have time to eat it. So eventually, it started to ferment, and people were starting to feel happy when drinking it.
But I think this is unique to grapes, isn't it? Because the same thing doesn't happen with other fruits, but for some reason, really,
definitely.
Doesn't take much to cause fermentation. I mean, you get sugar and yeast together, and they'll party as long as there's sugar to be had. I'm sure in the Garden of Eden, the apples were fermenting quite nicely, which may have had an effect on the decision-making there.
Well, apple cider, but that's but different than wine.
With wine, of course, it's, you know, wine makes itself, and all you need are naturally occurring yeasts that come in contact with the sweet juice on the inside of the grape, and fermentation will take place. If you're making wine formally, of course, you want to control that process more, but it's pretty straightforward.
Well, do we know about the earliest origins of wines? Anybody know where wine was first made?
They say that the first wine was made in Azerbaijan or in the Armenia region in the Middle East. And then it spread from there.
Uh-huh. Why do you think that we don't see more important wine? Well, Azerbaijan is now a Muslim country, so wine is prohibited, at least by the religion. But why do you think we don't see more wine from that general area? Is it
well, maybe it's because
not as good for making wine?
Well, it's probably because it's all drunk locally.
Well, I mean, they're of course.
And Georgia, of course, is a big winemaker, and they've had some problems with Russia recently. I've been reading about that in the newspapers.
Huge. I mean, Georgia's a big producer. Russia was, for years, the biggest producer of sparkling wine in the world. Most of it, you know, impossible to drink, but nonetheless, there it was. And if you get down to the Middle East, there's wine made in Israel. There's wine made in Lebanon, the Bekaa Valley, actually. The grapes, because I just talked to some friends, the Hoshars, who run the most famous winery there, Chateau Mizar.
With missiles going over their vineyards. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they describe the fruit in one of their wines as truly explosive.
Without the shrapnel.
Neither here nor there.
But I assume that it was the Greeks or the Egyptians before them who really got winemaking as we know it going.
Yes, because they were growing grapes. I mean, in Iran, then Persia, the town of Shiraz, you know, gave birth to the grape, the eponymously named grape. So viticulture has gone on for thousands and thousands of years, and invariably, wherever people are growing grapes, someone is going to make wine.
So why do we associate France with wine?
Well, I think because in France, they subdivided the regions into appellations where each region has this particular style and particular grape varieties that grow best And they kind of categorize it, and that's a little bit same thing with their food.
You can blame it on the Romans too. I mean, they sailed up the Rhone River and sort of left their viticultural imprint all over the place. You see it today even.
Well, and then later the popes came there to the Rhone Valley, and Chateauneuf du Pape.
Always good to have a French pope. You know, do you know that wine is going to be a part of it?
So what do you think is the most important part of making wine? Is it, as some people say, the growing of the grapes, the farming part, or is there real skill in taking grapes and making them into something that's quite special?
All three. The viticulture, the vinification, the yield, the grape varieties, the alcohol content, all that goes into play.
You know, I said that wine makes itself, but of course man has to intervene to make a liquid that's not prosaic, but something that's poetic. And there's so many different decisions that winemakers and grape growers can make along the way affecting what the wine ultimately tastes like.
So first you have to grow it, and you have to know how to grow it in a way that's going to lend to good wines. I've heard that the best wines come from soil that is rather that is not the best soil.
Right, poor soil.
With chalk and chalky or stony soil.
Yeah, but with good drainage so that the roots can go down deep and into the mineral pockets.
You know, you want really what the opposite of a lot of fruit growers want when it comes to making grapes that go into wine. You want the vines to struggle to put all of their energy into as few grapes as possible and really mightily fight for the nutrients in the soil. And the more stressed the vine is, oftentimes, the more intensely flavored the grapes are, and therefore the more intensely flavored the wine is.
Well, if you bite into a grape, you notice that none of them are red. So how do we wind up with red wines and white wines and rosés, a little bit of both?
Well, you can make white wine from both white grapes and red grapes. It's the juice inside. It's the maceration of the red grapes, the skins, that give the pigment.
So, in other words, if you take the skins out right away,
it'll
wind
white.
Up with white wine no matter what the grape is?
Sure.
If Champagne is a prime example of that.
You peel a white grape, the flesh is green. You peel a red grape, the flesh is green. And in order to make a red wine red, you've got to get that green flesh in contact with the red skin.
So when there are these champagnes that say Blanc de Noir, that means a white wine
out of
a red grape?
Right, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier.
And you talked about rosés. A rosé is just an incompletely made red wine. It's a red wine that has been partially made. The skins have been in contact with the juice for a very limited period of time.
My guests on Please Explain are Josh Wesson and Roger Daghorn, and we're talking about wine. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the things that I think confuses a lot of people is the names that wines have. In California, it seems to be named after a grape. In other parts of the world, there are other things that they're named after. I'm sure a lot of people can't figure out what is what.
It is confusing because there's no consistency across grape growing and winemaking regions. Some places use the name of the grape. Some people use the name of the producer. Sometimes it's the name of the place. Sometimes all three. And sometimes none of the above. It can be just a made-up name.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a consumer...
Well, why aren't they more consistent? Are they trying to confuse us?
Well,
the worst of the German wines.
They tell you way too much.
German is simple because it's basically grape variety first. That's most important. And then they go into categories.
Although for years, the Germans, of course, have been simplifying their own labels to try to make it easier for people to figure out what's what.
Yeah, sometimes they're in the simplification, they've made it more complicated.
So what are the different classes of wine? It's pretty obvious what distinguishes a sparkling wine from a still wine. But what about fortified and non-fortified wines?
Well, fortified wines is where a distillate is added to a still wine, whether before fermentation is complete or after fermentation is complete. This kicks up the alcohol level above 14% so that the yeast can no longer function. And if the fortification of the distillate is added before fermentation, there's residual sugar left over, and that's what gives it its sweetness.
So they tend to be sweeter and high in alcohol?
But you can also have a sweet, for instance, sherry can be sweet, even though it was vinified dry, by the addition of a dried out raisins that added to the dry white wine will give it sweetness.
What about brandies?
Well, brandy is basically boiled wine. You know, it's not hard to make it. If you just take a low-alcohol liquid like wine, which runs from 7%, let's say, to 16 or 17%, and you boil it and capture the vapors, you'll end up with brandy. And it's that very brandy that's often added to fortified wines to make wines like sherries or ports, giving that added kick. You can actually smell the brandy added in a lot of these fortified wines.
Yeah, water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas wine will boil, or alcohol will boil at 170 degrees.
So when you boil it, doesn't it get rid of the alcohol?
It evaporates, and then it condenses again at a higher alcohol level.
Just like in that mash still that you saw always going on in the back, they were just boiling low alcohol stuff to make high alcohol stuff.
Can any still wine be made into a sparkling wine?
Well, sparkling wine, if we're talking about the sparkling wines that are made in a style of champagne, are actually made twice. They make the wine first in an open vat.
Dry.
And they pour it into a bottle that's super strong, super thick. That's why champagne bottles are twice as thick as regular still wine bottles. Then they add more yeast and sugar and cap it and let the yeasts eat the sugar, and the carbon dioxide that's produced stays in the bottle and makes it into sparkly wine. So you could technically take any still wine and turn it into a sparkling wine.
But there are many different ways of making sparkling wine. But the traditional way is what they call the Methode Champenoise, which is, as Joshua was mentioning, that the second fermentation takes place within that bottle.
But there are some cheap ones where they just pour some
CO2
in, just as though they were making a soda.
Yeah.
Correct.
And then there's in between, you could do it in a giant vat and then put it into the bottle. And in fact, that's the way a lot of a very popular wine called Prosecco is made. It's made not in the individual bottles, but in large vats, and it's very delicious, meant to be drunk young.
Well, many sparkling wines are labeled non-vintage. What does that mean, and how significant is vintage for judging a wine?
Well, non-vintage is it's a crazy term because it suggests that the grapes were never grown. It's a virtual wine.
But it's a blend.
It means multi-vintage. It really should be MV, not envy, because when a winemaker says, my wine is non-vintage, they've blended across years, usually to cancel out the effects of a year.
Champagne is...
So they can have the same taste every year?
Every year, exactly, to get consistency out of an agricultural product that is, by definition, inconsistent.
But then a vintage wine, we want each one to taste different? That's why somebody says, oh, this is from a such-and-such vintage, and everybody says, meaning, that's going to be really good.
It's a very special vintage. But there's still the blending part, the cuvée, that's even in a blend in a vintage, because it would be a blend of grape varieties, pressings, vineyard sites, even with a vintage cuvée. But the thing is, the non-vintage brut is generally the house style, and that dictates how one champagne house will differ from another.
So the cheapest one, usually, is the one that tells you what the house style is.
Right.
But it happens to be the one that champagne producers are most proud of, because it represents their style. It's essentially a proxy for what their house is all about.
I remember an article in the Times some years back which asked, is a $120 champagne that much better than, in those days it was a $12 bottle of champagne. Now it would be 20-something. I don't know. What's the cheapest champagne these days, real champagne?
It was $25. Probably.
Okay. So is would it be...
Well, better
that much better, or
yes,
I disagree, Roger, because better is a subjective term when it comes to wine. You know, once you
if you got the money, I guess it's fine.
But you know, I play this game all the time with people, where I will lay out five wines from $5 to $100. They'll be wildly different. They're not consistent. I can have a sparkling wine, a still, a white, a red. And in the blind, I give them five cards with the prices marked on each. And all I ask is that they put the card with the wine. And they can't do it. I can't do it. It's impossible to. If you have good wines and you're relating to them in a positive way, you can't attribute pleasure to price.
Because price is often determined by other factors.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think when it comes to champagne, the Tête de Cuvée or the Cuvée Prestige comes from better grapes and less pressing, more free-run juice, and it makes a difference, I think, though. even if it's a lighter champagne, whether that's the style of that particular
I don't think that, I mean, in a blind tasting, you'd be able to always pick the Tête de Cuvée over the vintage or the vintage over the Brut. I challenge you, Roger, the next time.
Well, next time you're on the show, bring a lot of great champagnes and we can do that. But you did bring some wines, and looking at these couple of glasses with wines in them, I know that whenever I've been with people who are knowledgeable about wine, the first thing they do is they tip the glass and stick their nose in it, and then they often swirl the glass around, and the rest of us look at them like they're crazy.
Well, you know, it's not an affectation, because 90% of what we think of as taste comes from our sense of smell. So when you see people at wine tasting swirling the wine around, what they're doing is allowing the molecules in the liquid of the wine to evaporate and come up and meet you halfway. And when you smell the wine, you're really getting a sense of what the taste is. It's really just a précis to the taste, but it's the most important one that you can evaluate.
And you could also enjoy the wine right from the very beginning, just looking at the glass. It's enticing.
In fact, Alex Bespalov, who's a mentor of mine, said, you know, I just look for a wine on my palate to confirm what my nose has told me.
Well, what's the difference between an aroma and a bouquet then?
Well, you know, a lot of people use the terms interchangeably, but a bouquet is often ascribed to a wine that has had some age or developed some complexity, where aroma can just be the immediate sensation of whatever the wine is when you're smelling.
And can a knowledgeable person separate the two they're sniffing this wine?
Well, I mean, it's a matter of definition, but people use the term interchangeably these days, so I don't parse it that finely. I think aroma bouquet, however you describe the nose of a wine, is appropriate as long as you're getting a chance to smell it.
People also look at the color of the wine. Why is that important? Because they're pretty good wines have very different kinds of colors, don't they?
Oh, sure. Certain grape varieties have different intensities, hues, and it may also determine where the grapes come from. Warmer climate white wines, for instance, would be darker yellow, whereas a cool climate white wine may have a pale straw with a greenish hue to it.
And why is that?
Well, when we go in the sun, we can actually change color. When grapes go in the sun, they can't change the color of their skin, but they can get thicker. It's a protective mechanism that they have. So when Roger was talking about warm climate grapes, white wine grapes in the sun, they have thicker skins, and almost all the color in the wine comes from the skin. So it makes sense.
We are going to take some calls from listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. We haven't talked about all sorts of things that I know have confused me over the years and everyone else. And one of the confusions we hope to clear up later is why Josh Wesson called his book Red Wine with Fish. Haven't we all been told that fish always gets white wine? And we'll find out why some people say, I only drink dry wines. What's wrong with sweet wines? And maybe there are things that are wrong with sweet wines. What else should we talk about? Whether Americans are drinking more wine, and whether they should, and where should they go other than bestsellers to find
and nowhere, should they fear screw caps?
Yeah, should they fear screw caps? Okay, well, all of those things and more. 212-433-9692. My guests are Josh Wesson and Roger Daghorn, and this is Please Explain, talking about wine. And we're back with two wine experts, Roger Daghorn, the master sommelier with the Tribeca restaurant Chanterelle, Josh Wesson. Why do I put a T in your name all the time? It's like the oil. Josh Wesson, Bestsellers Wine Stores, author of Red Wine with Fish, also a former sommelier.
Yes, I've hung up my cup, though, unlike Roger, who still dangles his.
Now, what does a master sommelier mean? Did you have to pass all sorts of tests to get
there? Oh, yes, but the beauty of it is that I no longer have to take any more tests.
You've reached the pinnacle of sommelierness?
I don't know if it's the pinnacle, but it was a rigorous series of examinations, and I'm glad it's all over for me.
Should we take some calls? Our number here is 212-433-9692. And Alex from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Roger. This is Alex.
Hi, Alex.
How are you doing?
Good.
I used to work at Lazink, and your wine tastings there taught me more about wine than anything before or since. So I
thank you.
My question was, there's like a lot of, I don't know if it's hype or if it's real, surrounding the 05 Bordeaux, and I was wondering if you've tasted them, if they're that much better than say, the 2000 or the 89s, or, you know, even going back to, like, the 60s. I think, like, 61 is supposed to be really good. And are they that much better, or is it just, like, are they trying to sell futures?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of both, but I think that the 05 was a big vintage. I did taste some out of barrels when I was there. It's difficult to tell how they will age, but overall, it's a good indication that they will be particularly good and long-lasting and a rich vintage, probably much like the 2000.
Okay, so it's probably a good investment, but not like...
Well, it'll be an expensive investment.
But, right, right.
But basically, we are here that a certain wine is the wine of the century, or the vintage of the century. And I remember over the last 50 years about 10 or 15 vintages of the century. So.
Well, there's an old joke, of course, in Bordeaux. They used to say the best wine was the one they had to sell that year. But 2005 is an extraordinary year, as was 2000.
And what would make something extraordinary?
No rain and a lot of sun. And basically conditions that don't get in the way of diluting the grapes or harming them.
But that's the case in California, and yet, although there are great wines from California, it doesn't guarantee great grapes, great wines.
Well, you have to have the balance of sugar, acid, and tannin, so that if you have too much of one, it will detract from the other.
So in the case of California wines, there's a lot of sugar because there's a lot of sunlight, and...
By consequence, there's less acidity.
And it's interesting that you said sunlight, because the climate change has affected the average temperatures during the growing seasons in places like the Napa Valley. They've incrementally gone up.
You mean global warming is affecting winemaking?
Hugely. Which means that we should at some point be buying land in England, probably, for the next great wine region.
I heard they start to make great sparkling wine now in England.
But which is true. But my point about Napa is that you see the alcohol levels incrementally going higher and higher, due in part to the fact that there's more sugar in the grapes.
And some people are disturbed about that. They feel that when you have 16, 17, 18% alcohol, that really is beyond what a wine should be.
Well, you're almost,
those are the French snobs.
And you're approaching the entry level for fortified wine. And when you get to have alcohols at 16, 17, 80%, it can be problematic in the extreme for food.
And walking home after
and walking
a meal at a restaurant.
Yes, no lunching surgeons can be drinking that stuff.
Let's take another call. John from Jamaica, Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, folks. I have a question relating to homemade winemaking. If you wanted to make a nice full-bodied Burgundy, you know, I hear from certain makers that they use so many cases of white versus so many cases of red grapes. Does it really matter?
Well, of course it matters, but Burgundy, of course, is a place. And
yes,
you can't really make Burgundy outside of Burgundy. You can make Burgundy-style wines, and if you're making a red Burgundy, then you're using a grape called Pinot Noir. If you're making white Burgundy, then you're using a grape called Chardonnay. And I don't know whether you wanted to make a white or a red.
A red.
Well, maybe you should seek out some Pinot Noir grapes and take a shot at...
Can you just buy them?
Well, Pinot Noir is a very difficult grape to grow and to make wine out of, so it's a labor of love, and there's a lot more miss than hit.
You can buy juice, variety. Though. You can absolutely buy Pinot Noir juice and have it shipped to you no matter where you are, and take a stab at becoming the next great Pinot Noir winemaker.
But if he wants to make wine that tastes like the wine from Burgundy, he's going to have real problems because, except for a very few cases, Pinot Noirs outside of Burgundy don't taste anything like Burgundy Pinot Noirs.
Well, a lot has to do with terroir, the soil itself, the climatic conditions, the history in winemaking, so many variables, and already it's difficult to make it under normal conditions. And if it's outside the climatic zone and the soil types that are that Pinot Noir is comfortable with. It's very difficult.
You're not going to be making Burgundy style Pinot Noir, but you could make an interesting wine. But you need the grapes from Burgundy to get a shot at trying to make a Burgundy.
Although some people say that the Pinot Noir grapes from Oregon are pretty close. Is that because the soil is similar, or are there other factors? Do you know?
Well, actually, the soil is quite different in most of the areas where Pinot Noir is grown in Oregon versus Burgundy. But what is somewhat similar is the climate. And the relatively cool climate and length of the growing season and the exposure to the sun is not dissimilar in both places. So there is a thread of continuity that connects Pinot Noirs from Oregon and Pinot Noirs from Burgundy. But as Roger said, there's so many other variables that come into play that when you taste those wines side by side, oftentimes you can really detect which wines are from Oregon and which wines are from Burgundy, even if they're all good wines.
Or made by a French winemaker who's working in.
Yeah, exactly.
But even like New Zealand's making excellent Pinot Noir too, and that's still an area that's unexplored for most consumers. You know,
if John makes a nice one in Jamaica, Queens, we're going to have another good area of winemaking.
Closer to home.
Yes. Well, you can really taste the goût de terroir there of Queens. I would say this, though. I never understood the notion of trying to make a Burgundy in Oregon or a Bordeaux in California. Why not revel in the deliciousness of each place rather than try to create wines that all taste the same?
Tracy from Teaneck. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, thanks. My question is, some wines make me very uncomfortable and sick, and some don't, and I'd like to know how to tell the difference before I actually buy the bottle.
Well, when you say sick, what is happening? Are you feeling flush, headaches?
Yeah, I get really hot, and my stomach feels really uncomfortable, and I just can't drink it, or I know I'm going to be, like, physically ill.
Well, you may be allergic to sulfites, and
Sulfites. Well, I looked for sulfite on the label, and I didn't see it on the ones that I had.
Well, sulfite's a natural byproduct of fermentation. All wines have sulfites to certain degrees, some more than others.
And sometimes they're added, and they usually tell you on the bottle that they're added.
But they're in the parts per million, so it's often not the thing that's causing the problem. Because a lot of people don't know this, but there's sulfites added to orange juice. And in a glass of orange juice, there's more sulfites than you'd find in a glass of wine.
So some people will say it's red wine that is more likely to upset them, and I would assume that's the tannins or something else in the red wine.
Causing histamines that are in there.
On the other hand, we've also heard that red wines may really be good for our health and our blood systems.
Sure. They've preserved me pretty well so far. But, you know, wine is a complex beverage. Red wine contains about 400 naturally occurring chemicals. White wine contains about 250 to 300. And a person could be allergic to any one of those. So in terms of answering the caller's question, I think you'd have to find out if there's an allergic reaction going on, which probably is the case.
My guests are Josh Wesson and Roger Daghorn, and we're talking about wine on today's Please Explain. You have brought some wines here, and I have three glasses, in front of me. There's a white wine here. What is the grape in this?
Muscofilaro.
Now, usually when we talk about white wines, there are six or seven white grapes that we hear about, like Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, Chenin Blanc. But not Muscofilaro or whatever.
They use it as a sobriety tester when you're driving around Greece. They ask you to pronounce the wine.
Are there a lot of grapes like this around the world that we just don't know about?
There are many and many. And, of course, we're familiar with the most common ones, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Viognier, Sauvignon, and such. But there are so many other interesting grape varieties, and I just thought that to bring this particular one just to show an example of how great other interesting varietals can be that nobody has even heard of. This one in particular from an appellation called Mantinea in the Peloponnesus in Greece.
Now, why wouldn't somebody be also making wines out of this grape in California or in Australia?
Well, they could, but there's no demand for those grapes being turned into wines outside of Greece, so you wouldn't find a ready market for it, which is why you see so much Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Shiraz and Cabernet and Sauvignon Blanc and Riesling. People tend to think of them as the most important grapes, but that's not necessarily true. They're just the ones that have the most exposure in the marketplace.
And it's just recently that they're really coming into their own, because oftentimes in the past these grapes were grown, but they weren't making very good wines because of poor winemaking technique.
Well, we also, with red wines, how many times have I been in a restaurant and heard the person at the next table say, give me a Merlot?
Right.
Why is Merlot the wine of choice for so many people, at least until Sideways was made as a film?
You know, I'll defend Merlot, though. You know, when people say, I like Bordeaux, or I like Merlot, or I like Shiraz, or I like Chardonnay, they're basically using those places, grapes, names, as a proxy for a certain
style.
Taste preference.
Mm.
And the problem with saying, I like Merlot, is that Merlot's not monolithic. You can get light Merlots, you can get heavy Merlots, and Merlots in between. I brought a Merlot. Let's
is that
taste it.
What this red wine is?
The red wine's a Merlot. It
George
comes from
Chile.
Château
Petrus, that's Merlot. Yeah.
This is one of my favorite little Merlots, not so little. It's from Chile, and it's fermented in stainless steel, aged in wood for a little bit of time. And although Merlot is maligned, because a lot of it is nondescript and has no character, I think this wine has a fair amount of character. And it's $10, $11. You know, you don't really need to spend a lot often to get a lot of pleasure.
Let's go to some more calls. Angela from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You actually touched on my question with the previous caller, but I grew up in California, so I'm used to drinking California wines. My boyfriend is from France. He always complains that...
Sounds like a wine war in the making.
It is a bit, but it's fun trying to figure it out. He always complains that California wines taste New World, and at first I thought it was a bit of a snobbery on his part, but I'm starting to see what he means, and I'm wondering if you could explain that to me.
Well, there is a difference between New World and Old World, generally speaking. They say that Old World wines... Well, the Old World winemakers say that their wines taste earthy. New World wines taste chemically, whereas a New World winemaker will say that their wines taste squeaky clean, whereas Old World wines taste dirty. So there is that difference of opinion.
Another difference, too, which is the one that I think the caller is talking about, which is the exuberance of fruit that you find in New World wines,
yeah.
Which often you find a little bit more suppressed or diminished in Old World wines.
And some people say Old World wines are more food friendly. Do you think that's true?
Well, they tend to be lower in alcohol. They tend to be less muscular, and because of that, a little more restraint can be good on the dining room table. But there are lots of wines that are made in the New World that go beautifully with food.
Thank you so much for your call. James from Manhattan. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi. I'm asking about South African wines and how you think they pair up against the traditional favorites and why you think they, you know, only wine stores only carry a few labels when I know that there's some really good ones out there.
I think it's still a new wine world for us here in the States. Since apartheid, they've only become available to us. They've been available in England for quite some time already, and they've taken off well there. Here, it's a slow start, and they're still, I think, trying to find their niche.
But there's some extraordinary wines. Of course, they've been making wine in South Africa for a very long time, going back to the Dutch. And I've visited the winelands there twice, some of the most beautiful winelands in the entire world, extraordinarily breathtaking in their presentation. And the wines that are coming out of there, whether they're white or red, can be as dynamic as any wines in the wine world.
Weren't they handicapped by the fact that many people didn't want to buy South African products while apartheid was in place? And now they have to catch up with other countries like Australia and Chile and the like.
And there was another interesting byproduct of apartheid in terms of winemakers not having as much access to other winemakers, being invited to colloquies, going to conferences. So there was sort of a hermetically sealed environment for winemaking in South Africa for many years. But that, of course, has gone away, and there's been an explosion of quality and deliciousness coming out of that country.
Thank you for your call now. Libby. Hi, Libby, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Over the years, the last, I'd say, 5 years, we go to Norway. My husband's Norwegian. And I've noticed that, okay, the wine concern in Norway is a monopoly, but they've been getting boxes, 3-liter boxes of wines, Montepulciano's, Chilean, so forth and so on, and they're really good. And we don't have anything like that here. Is there any future for us in box wines?
About 10 years ago, there were a few that were on the market. They didn't fare very well, but I think there's a resurgence going on right about now.
In fact, they range from fairly inexpensive to the wine that Daniel Ballou and Daniel Jonas have just put out.
Detour, wonderful wine, yeah. There are so many variations on the box wine theme now. You're right, they did start in Europe and in Scandinavia, but I think that we're going to see more and more interesting alternative closures, boxes, bottles, bags, juice cans. I mean, it's going to be a very exciting world.
And is that because people now are willing to accept not just having a bottle with a real cork in it?
Well, I think that there are two reasons. One, yes, we're much more willing to accept alternate closures like we are alternate vessels. But when you have cork, it's so 200 years ago, the technology, and it fails 3 to 5% of the time, and if you have a screw cap, it fails none of the time.
But screw caps, I understand, you just can't keep a wine as long. Is that true, Roger?
Well, this new Stelvin screw cap, apparently there is some air flow that allows some breathing, but I think there are other problems with screw cap as well.
And I'm assuming that for you, if you bring a wine to a table in Chanterelle with a screw tap, no matter how good, people are going to say, ooh, what happened there? Anyway, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Roger Daghorn, the sommelier of Chanterelle, and Josh Wesson, who is the co-owner of Bestsellers Wine Stores and also the author of Red Wine with Fish. Thank you both.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, director Stephen Frears tells us about The Queen, a behind-the-scenes look at the royal family's struggle to balance their desire for privacy with the public's demands following the death of Princess Diana. And then jazz singer Stacey Kent on her new collaboration with her tennis sax-playing husband, Michael Lewis, the author of Moneyball, on his new book about football. And a past-present segment featuring a recently discovered interview with Tennessee Williams, plus a fascinating magmatic rift in Ethiopia. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Chris Bannon is the executive producer. We had help today from Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, Tess Hartman, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday. Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.